All right. I'm going to go ahead and get started while folks are joining us. Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us for today's IL conversation, Parenting with a Disability. I'm really excited about this one. It's going to be a great conversation, and it's the final one in this year's series. If you need access to CART for today's call, please go to the April website at www.aprIL-rural.org, and you can follow that link right on our IL Conversations tab. If you're having trouble accessing it, you can always email me, and that is mary.olson, O-L-S-O-N, at mso.umt.edu, and I can send you those links directly. Today's call is going to be recorded, and the audio recording and the transcript will be available online at our website under that IL Conversations tab following the call. We're also going to work with our speakers and hopefully get some resources up there for folks as well that we talk about today. During today's conversation, if you want to add to the topic from your experiences or if you have questions, please press star 2 on your phone to raise your hand, and then I can make your line live. When I unmute your line, you're going to hear the moderator state your line has been unmuted. Go ahead and ask your question at that time. Once your question's been answered, if you could go ahead and press that star 2 again, it just lowers your hand and it cleans up our queue. If you have any other questions, you can type them in our CART chat box as well, and I can voice those for you. Please remember to evaluate our conversation today on our website following the call under that IL Conversations tab. Your feedback's really important to us, and it only makes us stronger as an organization. This IL Conversation is presented by the ILNet, which is operated by the Independent Living Research Utilization Program, ILRU, in partnership with April, Nickel, and Utah State. Support for this IL Conversation is provided by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Community Living. No official endorsements of the Department of Health and Human Services should be inferred. And without further ado, I'm going to just briefly give you an introduction of the presenters, and then I'm hopefully going to let them introduce themselves a little bit as they're speaking. So we have got a great panel today. We have Sarah Launderville, Kelly Buckland, Kimberly Tissot, Susan Yan, Kara Ayers, and Nancy Bryden. And again, I'm going to let them speak a little bit about themselves and this great Nickel committee. And I hopefully pronounced your names closely, but please let me know if I didn't. Without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Sarah.
Hi, Mary. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Perfect. Yeah, so thanks so much for having us on the call today. I want to just take a moment and thank Mary Olson, who has been so helpful, not only for our call today, but all year long for these IL conversations. I'm so excited to be able to participate today. And I appreciate you organizing these calls and your dedication to education within our movement. So, as Mary said, I'm Sarah Launderville. I'm the Executive Director of the Vermont Center for Independent Living and the newly elected Vice President of Nickel. And I also get to chair this Nickel Parenting Task Force. Personally, I'm a mother of three kiddos. I have twin daughters who are 9, and I have a 7-year-old son. And I have a psychiatric disability, and so have lived experience around, you know, some of the challenges around parenting, but also some of the wonderful pieces around parenting and bringing forward how we talk and communicate around being parents with disabilities. So we have some excellent contributors to our panel today who I'll ask to introduce themselves, and they're going to share their personal experiences around parenting with a disability, as well as their experience within our Still network. And we hope to cover a bunch of topics today, including the task force itself, how you can get involved in our work, parenting rights, including termination of parental rights, reproductive assistance, guardianship issues, adoption, divorce and separation, equipment, and then also just advocating for legislation and what work your SIL or SILC can be doing around working with parents with disabilities. So obviously within 90 minutes, we'll only be scratching the surface of these topics, but in hopes that you will continue these dialogues within your state and where we should go next with these issues. So I want to turn it over first to Kelly Buckland, who's the Executive Director of the National Council on Independent Living. And Kelly, would you mind starting with a little about who you are, your personal experiences, and give everyone a little history about the work NICL has been doing involved, which led to this task force?
Yeah, absolutely, and thanks, Sarah. Well, I am Kelly Buckland, and I am the Executive Director of the National Council on Independent Living. I've been here for a little over 8 years. Prior to that, I was the State Independent Living Council Director in Idaho for about 15 years. And then before that, I ran a Center for Independent Living in Boise, Idaho for about 6 years. So I ran a Center for Independent Living, and I ran a SILC for a good amount of time. And I also am the father of a 18-year-old son who just moved away from home to go to college, and I'm going through parenthood withdrawals, I guess, or maybe just the change in how my parenting is done. It's done from afar now. So, but thankfully, we have things like FaceTime, and we have Skype and texting and all that kind of stuff, so I can stay in relatively good contact with him. So one of the reasons I mentioned my past about being the SILC director in Idaho is because that's really kind of how this stuff started. When we did our state independent living plan, we did a number of forums around the state in different cities, and we would get input from people with disabilities about what should go into the state plan. And when we did that, we got input from people with disabilities that they were losing custody of their children because they were parents who had disabilities. And so we put in our state plan that we were going to do something around this. And so we started up what we called in Idaho the Committee on Family. And we had a bunch of different members included on it. We had parents with disabilities, we had centers, we had attorneys, we had the PNAs, we had state child protection workers, we had the parent training centers and the DD councils, the university centers, and we had legislators on there as well. We had two of them that were prominent. We had the chair of the House Health and Welfare Committee, and we had the chair of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee. And what we did was we went through all of the current child custody laws in Idaho. We removed any discriminatory language that was in there, and there was lots of it, believe me. And then we put language in that built protections around parents with disabilities against discrimination, and then we created or tried to create what we considered a fair evaluation system of parenting, because just the whole way the system is set up, when they evaluate you as a parent with a disability, they start from a deficit model instead of how can they provide any supports to help you out as a parent. So we had meetings throughout 1999 and up to 2002, and we introduced legislation that covered child protection, adoption, divorce, separation, and guardianship. And the first year we introduced the legislation in the Idaho Senate, and it passed unanimously, but then it was killed in the House. So we tried to fix what we thought the problems we heard in the House were. We reintroduced the legislation in the Senate again in 2001, It passed the Senate unanimously again, and unfortunately died in the House. So we went back to the committee. We tried to fix what we thought the problems were addressed by the House. And this time, instead of starting in the Senate, we started it in the House. So, and we broke it up into two different bills, actually four different bills. So the first year we introduced it, in 2002, we introduced two bills, one that dealt with guardianship and adoption, and then a second bill that dealt with marriage and separation. And I think this is a kind of an important piece of the story because what happened was the chairman of the House Health and Welfare Committee went and saw the movie I Am Sam, which is about a parent with a disability, and he invited me and the entire House Health and Welfare Committee to go with him and watch it. And so we all did, and the movie, unfortunately or unfortunately, moved the committee to where those two bills went out of committee unanimously, went to the House floor, passed, went over to the Senate and passed, and were signed by the governor. So it was interesting to me that the movie with Sean Penn in it had more impact on the committee than real parents that we brought in and who testified in front of the committee. We had real parents who had their children taken away come into the committee, and a movie had more impact on them. So, I mean, it was good and it helped pass the bill, but it was bad in a way that Hollywood had more effect on them than real people. But the following year, we introduced two more bills, one dealing with child protection, one dealing with termination of parental rights. And they again passed out of the House and passed the Senate and were signed by the governor. So we had effectively addressed every child custody statute in the state. So we learned a number of things through this. One was you need to involve the courts, you need to involve the prosecutors, and you have to hold the line and be cross-disability and hold the line that this is a civil rights thing. It's not a child custody thing, it's a civil rights thing. So anyone who is abusing or neglecting their children should lose them. But it shouldn't be because of stereotypes and misconceptions and outright discrimination against parents with disabilities. So those were kind of the lessons I learned. Then I moved to D.C. to go to work at Nickel, and I'm about to come to the conclusion on my part here. And I had always thought it was unfair that we had been able to protect parents with disabilities in Idaho, but parents in the other 50 or the other 49 states and the territories didn't have protection. So I went over to the National Council on Disability, and I specifically requested that they do a report on parenting with a disability. They did do a report, and I specifically requested that they put model legislation in the report as well. And as a lot of you probably know, Robin Powell did the report, and she just did a fabulous job on it. So did the National Council on Disability, and it's called Rocking the Cradle, and it's on their website if you haven't seen it. And then that started it into a national movement, and Nickel then at that point started up the parenting task force that Sarah talked about, that underneath the ADA Civil Rights Subcommittee of the Nickel Legislative Advocacy Committee. And Nickel's been doing some national work on this really since then. And I'm just really happy that we have this opportunity to present that work to you all today. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Sarah.
Thanks, Kelly. I really appreciate your description of how laws generally start from a deficit model instead of a supportive model. And it is really amazing how that movie, I Am Sam, helped push forward that legislation. It really goes to show how movies do indeed influence people in our movement, and something that we always have to be really mindful of. And you're right, this is indeed a civil rights issue. I want to turn next to Susan Yuan, who knows a lot about attitudes and has spent her career working on parental rights. And Susan, can you let us know a little bit about TAS, the organization that you work with, and your personal experiences, and the work that you've been doing, including your experiences around child protection and the assumption that you've seen that people make around folks who are parents with disabilities?
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Kelly. I got into this field of disability because I'm the parent of a 43-year-old man with disabilities who communicates by typing. And that got me into the general field of disability, and from there I went into the family support field and was just cooking along fine, looking only at families who were raising children with disabilities, until about 20 years ago when I got approached around a situation of a mother with mild intellectual disabilities who was losing the custody of her son. And I got called in kind of out of the blue on that situation and got to know the mother, and ended up in the end as guardian for her son for the next 6 years. You know, the way we kind of stumble into things. And the reason that I ended up as guardian for her son was that her parental rights were clearly going to be terminated, but she asked me if I would be guardian so that she wouldn't lose contact with him. And he's now in his mid-30s, and they still have contact together. But from that one small situation, I got connected to the disability lawyers in Vermont, to the Protection and Advocacy and the Disability Law Project, and started getting called in on more and more situations. And I started being asked to do assessments and realized that I had to learn to do them right. And I'll talk later, if we have time, about what a good assessment is of a parent with disabilities in contrast to most of the things that are out there. But along the way, I also discovered across the country a small group of people scattered around the country who were trying to address the needs of parents with intellectual disabilities. And gradually we began to meet each other at conferences, and then we began to have our own conferences. And the more that we talked with each other, the more that we discovered that there was a need for an organization to begin to move things forward. And we created the organization known as the Association for Successful Parenting. And that group is focused primarily on parents with intellectual disabilities and learning difficulties, but we recognize that in order to do anything significant in advocacy, we really need to work cross-disability. And the more that I begin to talk about what the issues are that parents with intellectual disabilities face, the more other people chime in and say, yes, but that's the same for all parents with disabilities. So we created this organization, and it's a very committed group of people that includes lawyers, it includes social workers, and the lawyers and the social workers often fight with each other, and it includes people who run programs, you know, little scattered programs across the country. It includes researchers that give us information on what the latest research is, which then informs the kind of testimony that we can give in court. It includes psychologists who do the assessments and we're working very hard to make sure those are good assessments. And more than anything else, we never do anything without parents themselves. That both on our board and in terms of presentations that we do, we believe that it's extremely important to have the voice of the parent prominent. And we became a nonprofit organization in 2009 and have held five or six different international conferences. We have members right now from more than 30 states and four countries. And we try to work as much as possible, as I say, specifically for parents with intellectual disabilities. But when it comes to moving the agenda forward, we recognize we've got to be cross-disability. And I'm honored to be a member of the SILC, or the NICL Parenting Task Force. And I've also, this is my sixth year as a member of our state SILC in Vermont. I think I'll let other people talk and then talk a little more later about the myths that are out there around parents, the myths particularly in the child welfare system.
Great. Thanks, Susan. And I really appreciate you connecting all of these groups together within our movement. And I'm just super lucky to live in a state where we can access Susan around assessments to help us support parents with disabilities within our center. So next, I'd like to invite Kimberly Tassat, who's been a champion on our task force, to please share your personal story and what you've been working around, including information about reproductive assistance and adoption.
All right, great. My name is Kimberly Tiso, and I'm the executive director of ABLE South Carolina, which is a center for independent living in South Carolina, obviously, and we serve actually half the state, so we serve 23 counties. Well, let me tell you a little bit about my personal story. I am a woman with a physical disability, and I had had some fertility issues due to the side effects of chemotherapy and radiation. So my journey to parenthood started trying to first try to do in vitro fertilization through reproductive specialists, and the fight during that process was unbelievable. Just being able to be examined and being able to really get a full assessment of my situation and how and if I could even get pregnant. So that took probably about six different clinics and six different specialists to try to find somebody that would be able to see me and give me some answers. We ended up getting being very successful with that piece, not through pregnancy, but tried to also use surrogacy, and that was also a little bit of a complicated situation, but we did have a very close friend who was willing to do it, so we had an egg donation and went through all that. Unfortunately, that all failed. So I was destined to, and wanted to be a mother, so I decided that we were going to adopt. And I went to the Department of Social Services. We did all of the applications to adopt. And when my husband and I went to go sit down to finally adopt, they said, you are not allowed to adopt because you have a physical disability. Well, at the time, I was actually working for Protection and Advocacy. So they said that to the right people. So I was able to obviously fight for my rights. But you know, I always think about that story of what happened if I did not know my rights and just walked out. I would not be a mother, because shortly after that whole situation, I think my advocacy efforts really contributed to getting a placement immediately to be able to adopt. We actually got our son through the foster care system at 6 weeks, and that's not very common. But I now have a 7-year-old, a little boy, and we did adopt him through a lot of fight and struggle with the Department of Social Services, but at the end, it worked. So as a Center for Independent Living, what we have done is we've really looked at some of the systems change around parenting. And South Carolina, in the Rocking the Cradle report, South Carolina was was throughout having issues. We actually, our child welfare law actually said that a person with a mental deficiency, mental illness, or extreme physical incapacity could actually have their child removed and their rights terminated. And so that's just on the basis of disability. So we definitely wanted to do something to change that law and to just change the system overall in South Carolina. So what we ended up doing is our organization, our Center for Independent Living, little old us, we ended up writing legislation and having it introduced. And we had it introduced in 2015, and we started in the House, and it passed all the way through. There were some questions about people with mental illness, and that kept being the theme of the topic when we were talking with legislators. In 2015, that piece of legislation, let me just go back a little bit, was very, very broad. It included child welfare, foster care, adoption, reproductive health. It was very, very broad. What happened with the legislation is it ended up dying in the Senate. And so we said, well, let's regroup and let's get with some partners to help us write this piece of legislation and making sure that we had allies when we're going to the hearings. And so we ended up partnering with Protection Advocacy and Department of Social Services, believe it or not, to be able to craft a piece of legislation called the Persons with Disabilities Right to Parent Act to be able to get introduced. Well, of course, sitting down with Protection and Advocacy and Department of Social Services, PNA was obviously on our side, but Department of Social Services really kept getting hung up on, well, they thought that they really needed to continue keeping that language of mental deficiency, mental illness, and extreme physical incapacity in the legislation. So we, at the end of the day, we could not agree on the piece of legislation that we created together, but our organization ended up getting it introduced anyways with Department of Social Services not agreeing. So it got introduced into, it actually introduced in the House and the Senate both at the same time, and it passed, while it was in the House, Department of Social Services was supporting the bill with the exception of the section of TPR and removal because they wanted to keep those disabilities in. Well, during one of the hearings, the legislator that introduced the bill pulled them aside and said, you are violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so we had to convince the Department of Social Services to get on our side. That later that afternoon of that hearing, Department of Social Services called my cell phone and said, Kimberly, we're going to go ahead and we're supporting this piece of legislation. And so I ended up having Department of Social Services lobbying for this bill as well. But luckily, the bill ended up passing in May of 2007, and it's called the Persons with Disabilities Right to Parent Act. And it is a very a progressive bill, and especially for South Carolina. We removed all disability being a reason for termination of parental rights or removal, and it covers child welfare, so all aspects, including foster care and adoption. It covers the family court system, the removal process, so pretty much everything. And my favorite part of the piece of legislation is we have something in all of the sections regarding child welfare of the department or any other covered entity must not terminate the rights or remove the rights of a parent or legal guardian with a disability solely on the basis of disability. So that really got us covered. We also have that the department must comply with the ADA and Rehab Act as well. So it is a very progressive law, and we are very proud of it. And so now our job is to make sure that it's being used and being enforced. So we have been working very closely with the Department of Social Services and with changing their actual policies and procedures and their training. So not only are we involved, so a Center for Independent Living is involved, people with disabilities involved in creating policies for Department of Social Services around parenting, but we're also going and training all of their training their new staff members as they get them and their current ones to make sure that they're understanding that how to work with parents with disabilities. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that in a little bit.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Kimberly. Your story is, I'm always so impressed with you, but your story is so impactful. And I think that piece that you talked about, what if you didn't know that what your rights were, you know, you had already were an advocate and knew this. And I think that that's what really drives the work of our task force, because so many people within our IL network still don't have this information, and they do give up on this either dream or goal or whatever of being a parent. So that's really impressive. I also love your connection to the protection and advocacy to help support you as you led the charge in this. So proud that your center led the charge about changing the law in your state, and you did it truly to craft disability. And as a woman with a psychiatric disability and a parent, I appreciate that, because sometimes, as we all know, through legislation, some disabilities kind of get thrown under the bus for the, you know, sort of this greater good. And I think you should be really proud that you stuck with it and did it in a way that was really representative of our IL movement. That's awesome. Next, I'd like to invite Tara Ayers to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your adoption experiences that you've had.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tara Ayers, and thank you for having me today. So I, professionally, I'm the Associate Director here at the University of Cincinnati Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, and today, I also, in the room with me, have, as part of our LEND program, we have a seminar in evidence-based medicine this year dedicated to the Disabled Parenting Project, to which I'm a co-founder, and so we have our SEBM team with me today, too. This time happened to coincide with when we typically work on this project. So in addition to co-founding the Disabled Parenting Project, I also sit with Susan and others, I'm sure, on this call on TASP on the board. And just recently became a consultant for the National Center for Parents, National Research Center for Parents with Disabilities. So that's kind of my professional stake in this. But personally, yes, I'm a parent of three. I have a 10-year-old son, Eli, a 7-year-old daughter, Hannah, and a new 6-month-old, Riley. And so Eli was adopted after my daughter, Hannah, so we went a little bit out of order, from China, and I have a physical disability. I have osteogenesis imperfecta, and use a wheelchair full-time, and as does my husband. So we knew that several, we're connected to the community, Little People of America, and we knew of several couples where both couples had different forms of dwarfism had adopted, but we weren't aware of any couples where both parents were in wheelchairs that had adopted from China. Culturally, that's kind of viewed as a different kind of severity of disability. So we embarked on that process kind of knowing that we knew how to fight for our rights through the American system, but we knew that it would take some cultural negotiations and patience to do that. But we were able to figure out how to do that successfully. We adopted him. It took about a year, which is average or typical, and we brought him home in 2014. And then since then, I've been able to kind of provide peer mentorship to some other parents with disabilities. I haven't yet come across or been asked to support a couple like us where both parents have disabilities and use wheelchairs, but I've definitely been able to help other parents where one parent may use a wheelchair. It's everything from the travel aspect of going to China to actually adopt your child, but we found that before that it was important to really emphasize the strength of what we can bring to the table as parents with disabilities, and that's also what I focus on as a researcher in terms of looking at it from a strength-based approach, and that there are specific aspects of the experience of having a disability that if we look at those and we talk about those, that they bring a specific strength to the table as a parent. So that's kind of my experience, and I'm excited about the call today.
Thanks so much, Kara. Sorry, I was on mute. And thanks for giving us that perspective of adopting from another country and then also providing peer support to others looking to access the system, which is oftentimes really difficult for folks. I'd like to ask Nancy Bryden to introduce herself and tell us about a situation that is going on within the Vermont Disability Law Project. Nancy, are you with us? We can't hear you.
I'll check on that at my end, Sarah.
Awesome. Okay.
While we're looking at that, I just wanted to remind folks that while we're going, please do press star 2 if you have any questions, and we can start to get you lined up. And then when we break for questions, we can know who's ready. So I'll let you go ahead and finish in, and I'll see how we can get Nancy patched in.
Awesome. Okay. So we'll move on a little bit. One of the issues that we've talked about in our at our task force meetings are issues around separation and divorce and what happens around parenting. And I want to open it up to anyone who's on our panel, but maybe Susan, if you want to start us off, that would be great.
Am I off mute?
You're off mute.
Okay. Well, one of the issues around separation and divorce is that while when a parent is has a child in custody through the child welfare system, there's automatically going to be legal representation provided. Now, the quality of that representation varies dramatically, sort of with the lawyer that you end up with. But I've seen some incredible lawyers that were assigned to work with parents at no cost who did beautiful jobs, and I've seen others that didn't pay much attention to the case. But when somebody's going through a divorce or separation, there's no lawyer provided for the parent with a disability. And most parents with disabilities, or I would say at least many parents with disabilities, don't have the assets to be able to go and hire lawyers to represent them. So for a start, one of the things that needs to be addressed is trying to get them connected to pro bono lawyers who will take this on. I was involved with a situation in Vermont where a mother had a public guardian, and usually, you know, we kind of wrestle around guardianship issues, but this was a wonderful public guardian, and she scoured the state until she found a pro bono lawyer who would take on representing this mother in a custody battle with her ex-husband. And it ended up very successful, even though the mother did have a documented intellectual disability and even had a guardian herself. But the pro bono lawyer was able to argue for her. But very often, there's just the same assumption in the courts as there is with regard to custody issues with child protection, that the disability is going to get in the way of parenting. And that's, once again, where getting good parenting assessments is extremely important. And I know that through the Looking Glass, which was the National Center for Parents with Disabilities up until about a year ago, but they had a lot of assistance that they would offer around assessment of the needs of parents, particularly with physical disabilities, for accommodations. And if you can begin to get a good assessment that says, look, if you have this, this, and this in place, the parent can be successful, that will begin to stand up in court. So the issue of assessment with parents with intellectual disabilities, it's even more difficult around issues of assessment, both in divorce court and with child welfare, because people still throw around IQ measurements as something that's relevant to parenting. And we've been able to go in now, we have enough research accumulated through TASP, that we're able to go in and basically testify that there's no reliable correlation between IQ and parenting skill until the parenting skill is between 50, in parenting IQ is between 50 and 60. So a parent with any kind of an IQ can be a bad parent. You know, you can have an IQ of 160 and be a lousy parent. But there's no reliable correlation between IQ and parenting until the IQ is a lot lower than most of the parents that are involved with intellectual disabilities. So just trying to find the research to back that up and trying to get good assessments. And I want to say something about the power of assessments. There was a case in 2015 in Massachusetts that was called the Sarah Gordon case. And, of course, that's a pseudonym to try to hide people's identity and give a little privacy. But it was a case where a parent with an intellectual disability was denied the right to raise her daughter, even though she had a good support system in place. And because we'd been working on this issue of assessment for quite a long time, and we'd had good training from Maurice Feldman of Canada, who's done a lot around parenting assessment, Dr. Nicole Brisson, who also is from the lovely state of Vermont, was able to testify in that Massachusetts case, which was in the midst of a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice and the Office of Civil Rights, through that case, found that discrimination had occurred. And it became a landmark case that really extended the power of the ADA much more over parenting than it had before. And following that decision, then TASP worked with the Office of Civil Rights and Department of Justice to come up with guidelines for child welfare agencies that were also put out in 2015. And if you want to find these things and you're willing to dig a little in a website that still needs work, the organization TASP has a website called www.achancetoparent.net. And we have those decisions and we have the guidance to child welfare agencies available on that website, as well as a lot of other information. Do we toss it back to other people and then I'll come in later on other situations?
Yeah, thanks, Susan. Before you mute again, you talked about the importance of assessments. Where can people throughout the country go to access services like assessments if they wanted to?
Well, I would say that parents with physical disabilities should still contact through the Looking Glass. I believe it's www.lookingglass.com, but you can find it easily by Googling through the Looking Glass. And they've worked with many independent living centers, so this should not be a new resource because they've been there since the 1980s, and they've been accumulating that expertise in how to do appropriate accommodations and also how to do appropriate assessments. If you're interested in finding out more about assessments for parents with intellectual disabilities, and we're also doing some assessments around parents with mental health issues, as well as traumatic brain injury, you can contact me at syuan@uvm.edu or through TASP, the Association for Successful Parenting. And we can link you to, there only have been a handful of people really trained to do these accommodated parenting skills assessments, but we know who they are and we can try to link you with them. I know Nicole Brisson is going all over the country doing assessments right now.
Great. Thanks so much, Susan. Any of our panelists want to weigh in on divorce and separation issues, stories, or how you're working in your center around those issues?
This is Kimberly with Able South Carolina again. So something that we have taken on is we're just really making sure that there are no more horror stories, so there's no one being turned away, so that we're making sure that people, all of our consumers, are aware of not only their rights but also their parenting rights, because I think this is a topic that folks aren't really used to hearing. They're not used to hearing about family planning or any of that. And so even with all of the five core services, parenting can be a huge piece of that. So just building up those skills so that, you know, discrimination isn't occurring. And that could happen with family planning and divorce and all of that. So that's something that we've been just doing.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Anybody else around divorce separation that they wanted to weigh in on our panel? Great. I do see that Nancy's on the call. I just want to see if she's unmuted at this point.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can. Thanks so much. Could you introduce yourself and tell us about the work that you're doing at the Vermont Disability Law Project?
Sure. My name is Nancy Bryden. I'm the director of the Disability Law Project, which is a special project within Vermont Legal Aid. We are not the protection and advocacy agency in Vermont, but we do subcontract with Disability Rights Vermont, which is the designated protection and advocacy agency, to do a good deal of the protection and advocacy work. We have four attorneys statewide, and we provide representation to people with disabilities in a variety of legal matters. One of the things we do, we've worked with Susan and Nikki Brisson on cases involving parents with disabilities. Sometimes we will co-counsel with the attorneys who are assigned to represent parents in termination proceedings and work with that attorney to either get needed accommodations in the court or get an accommodated evaluation or just raise whatever disability-based discrimination issues we might see in the case. We're currently involved in a case where Dr. Brisson did do the evaluation. Case is going to hearing next Tuesday and involves a young woman with an intellectual disability whose parents have unofficially taken custody of her 3-year-old daughter and filed a petition to get guardianship over that daughter. And our client does not want her parents to have guardianship over her daughter. And so we are representing her in trying to defeat that petition for guardianship so that she can maintain full guardianship of her child. So Dr. Brisson did an evaluation in that case, a great evaluation. And as I said, we're going to hearing on Tuesday, and hopefully we'll get a good outcome. Sarah asked me to speak about another case that we were involved in Vermont, and this case involved a state termination of parental rights for a mother of her 2 children. The case, we did not get involved in the case at the trial level. We were asked to come in and submit a friend of the court brief in an appeal of the termination case in the Vermont Supreme Court. But to go back to the facts of the case, the mother was somebody with a significant hearing impairment, and one of the children also had a hearing impairment, and interestingly, the guardian ad litem who was representing the children in the trial also had a hearing impairment. So early on in the proceeding, the attorney for mother let the trial court judge know that mother had a significant hearing impairment and that they would need to be using these assisted listening devices, which I think most courts have these days. And it appeared from the record that throughout state parental termination proceeding, they go on for years. And I think that this case, I think it was maybe 3 years of different court hearings over the course of 3 years. And from the record, it was clear that those assisted listening devices were not consistently used. And it appeared also that when it was drawn to the court's attention in the context of any particular hearing that the listening device hadn't been employed or engaged, the judge would turn around and say to the parent, well, you know, what's your problem? Why don't you speak up? Say something. Be assertive if the device isn't on or if it's not working, and which is not the way it should be. There's an extreme imbalance of power in a courtroom, and it's really putting a great deal of a burden on this mother to speak up and interrupt a court proceeding and say, Your Honor, I can't hear anything. her attorney should have asserted that throughout the proceeding, and that's a problem that the attorney didn't do that. At another point, the court instructed the attorney and her client, the woman who was hard of hearing, to use the microphone at counsel table to be able to communicate, for the attorney to talk with the parent or the mother, because somehow the other device wasn't working. And the attorney pointed out that, well, if she was using this microphone to communicate with her client, what the attorney was saying was being broadcast throughout the courtroom and, in fact, recorded, and that would be contrary to the guarantee of confidential communication between an attorney and a client. And the judge at that point just said, well, you can have your privilege to confidential information, or you can hear what's being said, but you can't have both, which was a pretty outrageous comment from the judge. So these kind of problems with the equipment not being engaged or not working effectively continued to happen throughout these 3 years of various court hearings. I think there were 17 hearings in all. And at the end, the parent lost custody of her, or lost her parental rights. The court terminated her parental rights based on the fact that mother didn't show up on time for the final merits hearing on the case, the final trial on the case that was scheduled for a 3-day hearing. And apparently mother had been confused because she hadn't been really able to hear very well. She was confused about the day of what day the hearing was going to start. And so she wasn't there. She wasn't there kind of a half an hour beyond the start time. And her attorney asked that the court hold off on proceeding, and the court said, we'll try to get in touch with your client. And the attorney was able to get in touch with the client, and mother said, you know, I didn't know it was today. I'm on my way. I can be in the court in half an hour. And the judge said, too bad, we're going to go ahead and held the hearing without mother and issued an order terminating the mother's rights. So that's the case that went up to appeal to the Vermont Supreme Court. And we filed a friend of the court brief outlining all of the violations of the mother's rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that she had not been provided with needed accommodations in the proceeding. Interestingly enough, at the time of the oral argument in the case, right before the oral argument, the Chief Justice of the Vermont Supreme Court sent out a notice to all of the attorneys involved indicating that he had a hearing loss and that he used the assisted listening device in court proceedings. And he just wanted to know if it was okay with all the attorneys if he still sat on the panel that was going to hear the case. And nobody raised an objection. So the case proceeded, and was day of the oral argument came, and one of the attorneys was starting her argument, and a few minutes into the argument, the Chief Justice leaned forward and tapped on the microphone in front of him up on this high, you know, bench where they're sitting, and said, is this device working? I can't hear anything. So it was somewhat ironic that he was being subject to the same situation that this parent had been subjected to. The court ended up overturning the termination of parental rights, not on the basis of the failure to accommodate. The court actually refused to hear arguments on that issue for a technical reason. But it did overturn the parental rights termination. So mother retained custody of her children. While we had put a tremendous amount of work into this case, it's not all been lost. We're planning on meeting with the court administrator's office to point out the problems that were happening in this case, and I'm sure are happening in other cases with courts failing to accommodate whatever the disability a parent may have in a proceeding, and especially in a termination of parental rights proceeding. And we've also met with representatives from the United States Department of Justice on this issue, and we'll be following up with them. So it's pretty amazing that this many years after passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, we're still having to
fraud judges and courts, other court personnel, to make accommodations for parents with disabilities in court proceedings. So I'd be happy to answer any questions people have about this, but I think that that's all I was going to say.
Great. Thank you. And this is Mary again, and I just wanted to pop in here just for a couple of things. One is that we're so happy to have this panel of speakers today, and also one of the beauties of the format of IL Conversations is that we really want some audience participation. So I'm going to throw a couple questions out there, and hopefully we'll get some folks raising their hands. And again, to raise your hand, just press star 2 and you can join in. But I'm wondering, what do folks in the audience want to hear about? So what are your big questions about parenting with a disability? As in, what are some things you feel like you need to learn more about? What are some things that maybe you're trying at your center and are having trouble with? And while we're waiting for folks to join the queue with those questions, I had a question for the presenters, just wondering, what are your favorite tools and resources to take home? So if I'm somebody who wants to learn more about my rights as a parent with a disability or how to help others, what are your top, two places? And I do have one question in the queue while you guys are thinking about your favorite resources. Okay, go ahead, Carla. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. My name is Carla Walker. I'm an occupational therapist with Washington University in St. Louis, and we collaborate with Paraquad Independent Living Center, and as well as Through the Looking Glass. And wondering if you all have any new developments on assessment. So I know the folks at Through the Looking Glass have been working on the baby care assessment, and we've worked with them to help pilot it. But as far as any new measures that you feel are reliable and valid with parents with disabilities and would promote folks doing parenting assessments to utilize?
I'll jump in if I can. This is Susan Yuan again. And I'm going to talk more about parents with intellectual disabilities because I know that Through the Looking Glass has the expertise around parents with physical disabilities and sensory disabilities. But there, according to the researchers that are part of TASP, there are no tools that are normed on parents with intellectual disabilities. So when we do our assessments, we look at, we may look at some instruments that we use. Like, for instance, if somebody has said that the parent is under great stress, or they're worried that the parent can't handle stress, then we might do the parenting stress index, but recognize that in many cases we're doing it with parents that don't have their children with them. So they're not really in the real situation where they're dealing with their kids on a day-to-day
right.
basis. So that even the results that we find on that, even if they were valid, even if they'd been normed on parents with intellectual disabilities, they still might not be valid. But we'll use things like that. Well, there's another instrument called the Parenting Awareness Skills Survey that actually focuses on knowledge about parenting. And that's got a number of scenarios that kind of cross the age range from infancy up through teenage years. And there are 18 scenarios, and you tell the parent, for instance, one is your 5-year-old has a tantrum in the grocery store. What do you do? What do you say? They're very typical scenarios. And we use that. We don't score it. Because, for instance, parents with intellectual disabilities tend to give fairly short answers. And if the answer is short, it doesn't score well according to the chart that we're supposed to use to score it. But we use it to raise hypotheses in our minds. All right, maybe that parent doesn't understand the different stages of development. That might be a hypothesis that we get. But the largest part of our assessments are direct observation, that we spend at least 4 hours both in the home and in the community with the parent and the children, just observing what they do. So it's not so much what they say, and it's not so much what instruments say about them. It's what we actually observe in their parenting. And we try to look for things like problem-solving skills. We try to look at the way that the parents interact with the children. And that's what we base most of our assessments on, rather than tools. And we don't advocate the use of projective tests, because projective tests, you know, things like Rorschach tests, things like that, that are often used in assessments, they're not really measuring parenting skill. We want to look for something that measures parenting ability. We might look at the home inventory, which is out there, which does look at the environment. So we might look at something like that. But we stay away from personality tests and focus instead on what we can actually observe of parenting.
This is Kimberly, and we like to focus, too, on just going back to the Americans with Disabilities Act. The basic requirements is that any covered entity evaluate the person with a disability on an individualized basis. So sometimes those tools are not going to capture some of the needs just from an individual. So, it definitely needs to be individualized, and observation, and just like Susan said, just observing and seeing what works and what doesn't, and really brainstorming and coming up with solutions.
Yeah, this is Kelly too, and we in the legislation that we did in Idaho, and I think it's in the report too, really recommend that these, whenever if you will, like a study is done or the observation or whatever is done on parenting of somebody with a disability, it needs to be done by someone who has experience and knowledge on parenting with a disability.
Kelly, were you done?
Yes.
Oh, great. Sorry, it just kind of cut out. I wanted to make sure we didn't lose you. Did anybody else have any thoughts on that question before we move on to the next one?
Yeah, this is Susan again. For parents with intellectual disabilities, there's a book out by Dr. Maurice Feldman from Canada, and I think his co-author is Marjorie Aunos, A-U-N-O-S, and it's called Competency-Based Parenting Skills Assessment. And it really lays out the entire philosophy of how you appropriately assess someone with a disability, and the fact that you have to have knowledge of disability to start with. And that's in the APA guidelines, too, that parenting assessment should be done of people with disabilities should be done by somebody with disability experience. But it's very rare that that's the case.
Thank you. All right, we do have, if you don't mind, I might move along. We've got a couple more thoughts, actually, from our captioning audience. I've got one that says, I'm a wheelchair user. I had an accident when I was 17, and ever since, I have low quadriplegia. I'm really excited to share that I'm a father-to-be with my fiancé, but I keep thinking about how I will be able to be a good father for the child, especially when it will be an infant. Mm-hmm. I have limited use of my hands, but I would not like to miss the care for my child because of that. My fiancé is very supportive and tries to figure out ways to make it and find creative solutions.
I'm wondering if you know of any organizations or other resources that you can provide that can help in order to find out how to safely help raising the child.
Hi, this is Kara. I can chime in related to the Disabled Parenting Project. This was kind of the intention was to, because we found that the most knowledge was within our disability community. And so the Disabled Parenting Project is at disabledparenting.com, all one word. And there's also a Facebook page, which sometimes people like to post more specific questions, maybe related to, you know, how there's some great threads there about carrying an infant, and because sometimes the carrying method, they change. I know this as a mom to a six-month-old, the way that I carried her in my chair as a newborn has definitely changed a few times in just the last 6 months. And now that she has head control and more torso control, we have different options with carriers and things like that. But what is on the website is you'll find some videos that actually have parents with disabilities demonstrating certain, not only products, but certain ways that people have found to use products that almost all of them are just typical parenting gear that people have adapted for their own needs and uses. And I think parents with disabilities have really benefited from the fact that the parenting market in general has exploded. So there are many more kind of gadgets and tools and different carriers and things like that. But we would love to have, you know, I think we're especially in need of and want to hear from more fathers with disabilities. So we hope that this individual will hop on, and congratulations.
Yeah, this is Kelly. See, I'm a quadriplegic, and I just think what she just said is exactly right. Like, you really do need to talk to other people and peers, and I think if you surf the web and you go to the Parenting Project, you'll find a lot of resources of other people parenting. I'd start off, congratulations. Your entire life is going to change. Everything you do is going to be different now from now on. I think every parent on the phone can relate to that. But the amount of time that your children are in the infant stage goes by way too fast. So really appreciate it, and be as involved as you can be, and really enjoy the time while you can, because it goes by too quickly. Before you know it, they're going to be crawling up in your lap, and they're the ones that are going to be taking control over when they're with you and that kind of stuff. So really enjoy the time they're in for.
And this is Kimberly. I just want to make know that, you know, it's so easy to adapt to parenting. And I think any parent with or without a disability, there's always those concerns about being a good parent or not, and so it's no different in the disability community. We just, you know, it's just all about adapting and figuring out what's really going to work for you and trying out things. And you know, babies are scary, but you can figure out the best way to hold a child or to bond with a child, and it's through trial and error a lot of times. And that's okay. I think that's every parent. Every parent goes through that.
I really would echo that. And, you know, when I first became a parent, my sister gave me some of the best advice I think I ever got, and that was you just spend a lot of time with your children, and the rest of it comes kind of naturally. So.
This is Sarah. I think the other thing is, first of all, congratulations. And to broaden this a little bit to what centers can do, at our Center for Independent Living, we have a grant program where folks can access up to $1,500 for assistive technology. Yet at the top of the list always is assistive technology for folks who are becoming parents and or parenting, because we found that, you know, back years and years ago, when people's parental rights were being terminated, we wanted to come up with a solution, because some people's parental rights were being terminated, and case managers were saying that people couldn't raise their child because they didn't have, like, baby cry signals because they were deaf, things like that. So we said it's really important that we put forward some money to help people get the equipment that they might need. So I would encourage centers, if you don't do programs like that or connect with other places that can help people get access to that type of equipment so they can continue to parent.
Great, thank you. I do have just one more question from the chat room. Earlier we were talking about some different bills and legislation, and they were wondering if you could give us more information on those bill numbers or names so they could read them on their own. And before you answer, I just want to mention that, I'm going to not say your name right. I'm sorry, but the person in chat who asked the question, Kiriakos, says, thank you very much for all the helpful information, and I will make sure I will make good use of it. So, yeah, if you don't mind, or Kelly or whoever's speaking about the bills, if you could just tell us a little bit about the bill numbers and names so folks could look up at them, or we could make promise to have those up on the archive.
Give me just a minute. I'll pull mine up.
Perfect. And again, if you have any questions from the phone line, you can press *2, and that raises your hand, and we can make them live. But while Kelly is looking that up, that's all the questions that I have for right now. I'll turn it back over to you, Sarah.
Thanks so much. Yeah, so we one of the issues that comes up in our task force, and it kind of goes hand in hand with what centers can do, what folks can do around these issues. But I wanted, before I get to that, maybe Kimberly, if you could talk and anyone else on the panel around guardianship issues that you see within Centers for Independent Living, as that's something that we've talked about on our.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see this as far as guardianship of an individual with an intellectual disability, and we see this a lot of the assumption that people with intellectual disabilities cannot care for themselves or make decisions. And that's the exact opposite of what a Center for Independent Living believes. And so Centers for Independent Living should be very much against any type of guardianship situation. So that is not consumer control at all. And so we've actually seen this in parenting as well. We worked with a young woman in our state that has Down syndrome, and unfortunately, due to rape, she did become a mother, and her rights were very much violated in the very beginning, as her child was removed from her without even she was not even given an opportunity to parent. But one of the situations that did come up was that she did have guardianship. So that was something that we actually worked with her on, and we're making sure that we're going back and reversing that, because it is very difficult to be a parent and have guardianship. So that's and if all of you if you are going to the April conference too, there is going to be a session about supported decision making versus guardianship at that conference, and that's going to be really important for all centers to start learning that language of supported decision making and discouraging any type of guardianship, because that strips somebody's rights away.
And this is Susan speaking up, just with when you've been batting around this field long enough, you really hear some stories that just make you cringe. A situation with a woman who had an intellectual disability, whose parents were her guardians. She wanted very much to get married, and she wanted very much to become a parent. And her parents finally said that the only way they would give her permission to marry was if her fiancé would have a vasectomy. So, once again, the rights of people to reproduction just aren't compatible with someone else making the decisions. And there are so many other alternatives to guardianship out there that should be explored when people are at a point that they want to become parents.
Thanks, Susan. Is any,
okay, so, This is Kelly. I got the build up. So if you look at the Idaho legislative webpage, the two first bills passed in 2002, so you would go to the 2002 session of the Idaho legislature, and they are House Bill 577 and House Bill 579. And then the following year, 2003 legislative session, was House Bill 160 and House Bill 167. If you look them up, I've actually gone and done this, so it's easy to go to our legislative webpage and find those sessions and find the bills, and you can pull them right up and read all of the legislative language that's in there. I'm not sure, I don't remember if the Rocky McCrader report included the Idaho bills themselves, but they certainly referenced the Idaho laws a lot, kind of what held them up as the gold standard. And remember at the beginning when I gave my presentation about the MCD report, I mentioned that I requested that they put model legislation in it, and they did do that. And so there's model legislation in that report, too. I really would highly encourage you to look at that, because it it addresses some of the issues that we didn't think about in the Idaho legislation, like Kimberly was talking about reproductive technologies. That's not something that's in child testing legislation, but it's definitely something that advocates should be thinking about, because before you have children, the first thing is how to get pregnant. So, well, unless you adopt or something. But that's the same, that we did cover that in the legislation, but the reproductive technology stuff really is important. So look at that too. And then, Mary, your question, if it's not too early, your question about somebody who's not aware of their rights and the best resource to go to. I really do think that there was a joint letter published by the Department of Justice and the Department of Health and Human Services that talk about states' obligations under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I think that's really a good letter and really does bring into focus that even if your state legislation says awful stuff like Idaho did and like South Carolina did, there is federal law that requires that courts not discriminate against people, judges not discriminate against people with disabilities, and the social services system can't discriminate against people with disabilities under 504, under the ADA. And so there are federal laws out there to protect us, and I think the letter does a good job of calling that into focus. I think it could have been better, but I think it does a good job. So I would show that out as my favorite resource.
And this is Kimberly. Our bill is House Bill 3538, and it's called the Persons with Disabilities Right to Parent Act. And just going off of Kelly too, the HHS and Department of Justice technical assistance was key to passing this legislation, as well as the Rocking the Cradle report and the American Bar Association's resolution that they did. We actually contacted the American Bar Association shortly after they sent out their resolution, and they were able to actually not only write a letter of support for our piece of legislation, but was also able to send somebody to testify on behalf of the American Bar Association in support of parents with disabilities. So they were very much key to also passing our legislation. But just working with all of these you know, your colleagues in the field that are pushing disability rights. I mean, just start working with everyone to you know, make systems change.
And this is Susan.
Once again, the resources that have just been mentioned, the letter from the American Bar Association and the guidance from the Office of Civil Rights and Department of Justice, as well as that decision in Massachusetts that really started the strengthening of the ADA, that's all available, as I said before, on our website, www.achancetoparent.net. And it's not the world's greatest website, where we want to improve it, but if you dig, you can find the stuff on there. And also, I wanted to say that just in the last week or so, the new National Center for Parents with Disabilities, which is located in Massachusetts, just opened up their new website. And I know that you can find, I was trying to look for the website and I can't find it, but you can find it out by emailing Robin Powell. And her email is rpowell@brandeis.edu. And she has an entire document on there that looks at every single state's legislation. So it would have the numbers of all the states that have passed bills, and it would have a description of the characteristics. And then it also has information on which states have restrictive legislation. So it's a brand new resource, and I haven't really had time to explore that website thoroughly, but I can tell you it's good. So I know Robin would give you the website if you can just email her.
And Susan, that website is actually under Brandeis' website right now. So if people go to the Brandeis website, it's the National Research Center for Parents with Disabilities. And if you click on Parents, it'll take you to the table of state legislation.
Great, Sarah, and thank you for sending that. We have added that link that you sent to that table. It's in the chat cart right now, and then we'll be adding that to the archive on the website too, so folks can access that.
Great. I just wonder, I know we're getting closer to closing, Mary, but I would love to hear just some final thoughts on how SILS and SILS can be involved around this topic. And one thing I'd like to highlight is we know when we're working on these issues that people of color, people in same-sex couples, have this intersectionality around disability that oftentimes are more oppressed and are having a harder time accessing services, or parental rights are being terminated because of that intersectionality. So I think it's important when looking at how your SILS or SILS can be helpful around parenting issues when somebody comes through your door, to put that in your thoughts around your policies and procedures and how you're going to really rise up our entire community around these issues. I just wanted to open it up to our panel around any final thoughts around how folks can be helpful around this topic. And
I'll jump in very quickly again. It's Susan. And I would say try to be as inclusive as possible in your discussions and go cross disability, because I kind of cringe when I see bills that are very, very narrow, that really look at only the needs of one population, when you know that the needs cross all the disability populations and there's strength in advocacy together. So that would just be my plea.
This is Kelly. I'll second that.
This is Kimberly. Just as far as a center goes, I mean, just really incorporating the parenting rights in everything that you do, having that, you know, having that is ingrained throughout all the core services, and also doing a lot of cross training with your staff. We have 33 staff members, and that's something that we're really trying to work towards with making sure that everyone is an expert in this area so that they can provide more support. Because there's a lot of people out there that want to have children. They may be facing barriers, and we want to be that resource for them in our state.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, did you have any final thoughts for us on that?
No, I just
too. Actually, I just wanted to add one in, too. Just talking about what folks at home can do, I would just say also educate. So, you know, I'm so glad that Sarah came to us with this topic because it's one that been dear to me. I'm relatively new mom. My child is 2 now, but I also worked in home visiting for the public health department. And so I just wanted to say that there are lots of programs out there that aren't focused on disability, but for everybody supporting parents, because parenting's hard and scary, like Kimberly said. But one thing that I really tried to do was go in and educate all the public health nurses and all the public health social workers, and really just talking from that social model that, you know, people with disabilities can do everything that all the other parents can. They just need to do it a little bit differently. And here are some resources on how you can help, you know, referrals and such. So I think that's a big place for me is to start, is just finding some agencies out there that are already working with parents and go in and bring the disability voice to them.
And this is Kara, and I would echo that in making sure that everything that we do still embraces the idea of nothing about us without us, and remembering that it's so important to incorporate parents with disabilities, whether it be from research around this topic to actually our program planning and implementation, because, you know, we just have so much value that can be mined from the community. And so peer support, I think it can't be emphasized enough, the power that has, but it's something that people don't realize. You know, we often feel like we're the only ones out there, and so youth with disabilities aren't necessarily given the same assumption that sometimes in our society comes across as that this American dream, which, you know, everybody has their own unique version of the American dream, but if yours includes parenting, it can still include that if you're a youth with a disability. So I think from youth all the way through adulthood, that it's important to remember to incorporate the value of our disability community in every aspect of this. Thanks.
I love that. And I actually just made a mic live. We've got an audience member with some closing comments. Do you have a thought, question?
Hi, everybody. This is Shelley Hauser from Pennsylvania. I'm a listener. I'm also a parent with a congenital disability. I'm a congenital hemipelvectomy, which means I was born without my hip or my right leg, and I went on to having 3 children by a C-section with my own infertility issues in the beginning. But I just wanted to reach out to all of you in case you ever have a need. For the last 4 years, I have been honored and blessed to work with Villanova University here on the main line out of Philly, where they wrote the first national and now international OB simulation that I go in and I teach their nursing students and staff how to transfer me as if I'm a 30-year-old with a newborn after a C-section, and we go through this role modeling of how to work with somebody. You know, I carried my children on my crutches until I could fit back in my prosthetic that goes around my waist, and they've really found it to be very, very useful, and it was the first of its kind in the nation. And if anybody ever has that need, that they want me to talk to other physicians across the country and do a Skype, working here at the Phil, it is completely what we do, you know, to educate the staff. And because when I had my first child in 98, nobody knew what to do with me. When I got pregnant in 97, nobody knew what to do with me. And I emailed and tried at that time what was available to Google and email people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much had to be a pioneer and a guinea pig to the whole process. And I'm so honored to be able to help other mommies that want to be parents, no matter what their level of amputation or disability is. So if anybody, please feel free to reach out to me if that would help anybody that you work with in your little circles of this wonderful program. So thank you.
Thank you so much. That's so wonderful. Is there a way that we can get her contact information through the network?
I can put it on the little chat bar.
Perfect. Thanks so much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And then just one more. I know we're at the end, but I want to squeeze it in. Did you have a thought or a comment? Hello? Maybe not.
Oh,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
I can't.
Yes.
I was just wondering if there was any, you know, parting words about how to get more involved in the NICL parenting test board.
Hey, sure thing. Thank you for asking that.
That was almost like planned at the end of the life, wasn't it?
I know, and it wasn't. That's awesome. So our test meets the last Monday of every month at 11:30 Eastern Standard Time. And to join that work, you can contact me. It's at my email address, and we'll put this out through the contact. It's slaundreville@bcil.org. Or you can call me at 800-639-1522, and I'll get you connected with how to join that particular task force. So we do have a meeting this coming Monday, so if you're jazzed up about this, please join us. We'd love to have you.
Great. Thanks.
Great. Thank you again to all of our presenters and to all of you for joining us out there. Again, please remember to evaluate our conversations on the April website. And we will we'll be reaching out to the presenters to gather all the resources they talked about, and those will be available along with the transcript and the audio recording on the archive. Without further ado, I say we're closing out for the last IL conversation of the year. Thank you all again.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.